Mark Rowan-Hull is an artist who loves working with musicians and whose paintings have been inspired directly by musical works. He's also interested in the whole world of synesthesia, and if you're running for your dictionary, don't worry, we'll explain all that later on. It is this interrelationship of colour in music and colour on canvas that interests you, isn't it? And obviously, looking at this list, there are certain musicians, certain composers, who do that very, very significantly for you.
That's right. Particularly with, lately, I've been working with the music of Olivier Messiaen, where he was, in a sense, composing in colour, and he was very much seeing it as he was notating it. And I'm just fascinated by that crossover of the music becoming a painting.
There are other painters that one thinks of as having very close relationships with music. Somebody like John Piper, for example, who, of course, did an awful lot of work for Benjamin Britten.
That's right.
And, in fact, I think didn't you work with him at one point?
Well, I got to know him towards the end of his life, which was a great privilege, really. I got to know Mvanwy Piper, his wife, very well.
Well, of course, Mvanwy Piper, John's wife, was Britten's librettist.
That's right. Fascinating. She was actually also a great art critic as well. She edited a magazine called Axis in the 30s and was responsible really for bringing Picasso and Braque to the attention of this country. And
really?
Piper, yeah, I mean, she was fascinating, absolutely amazing woman. And I wrote when I was at college, I wrote a thesis on the involvement with Piper's designs and Britten's operas and how the three, the librettists, the designer and the musician work together to create the operas.
Is it possible to say, when you look at a Piper now, to say what qualities there are that seem to be so quintessentially, a rather good choice of words as it happens,
yeah,
so quintessentially suitable for Britten's music?
Well, there's a particular, it's a very particularly English sensibility about Piper's paintings, and you get that sense with Britten's music as well. I mean, I see great parallels with the music and the art in the operas. It really came together, and I remember that Mvanwy showed me a small Japanese sketchbook which inspired the designs for The Midsummer Night's Dream. I think they had long conversations about how the sets would look and how that would intermingle with the music.
It is rather wonderful when you get a group of artists all from the same period and even in the same area working on a project and sort of marrying ideas together in that way.
Yes, I find that very powerful, particularly with these operas. They really have that quality.
And why have you homed in, apart from the obvious Piper connection, with the Britten Turn of the Screw? Is that a particular favourite?
Yeah, it's a particular favourite. Also, I remember talking with Mvanwy about it and just how closely interlinked it all was. And the particular piece that I've chosen has the line from the Yeats poem. Mvanwy was a great knowledge on literature. Mm. And she picked out this ceremony of innocence is drowned, which is the theme and becomes his great theme, I suppose, from that point.
meant to follow where I lead. Slick as a juggler's mate to catch my thought. Proud, curious, agile, he shall feed my mounting pod. Then to his bright subservience I'll expound the desperate passions of a haunted heart. And in that heart, lost in my labyrinth, I see no truth, no truth. Only the foggy walls of evil press upon me. Lost in my labyrinth, I see no truth. Oh, ever since you have corrupted me, which way shall I turn? Shall I turn? I know imagine it, lost in my labyrinth, which way shall I turn, shall I turn? Lost in my labyrinth, which way shall I turn?
Wonderfully inventive score.
Yeah, lovely those bells at the end.
We heard the colloquy and soliloquy from the Turn of the Screw, Act 2, Scene 1 by Benjamin Britten, and we heard Peter Pears singing Quint Ada Mandikian, Miss Jessel, with the English Opera Group, conducted by the composer. You mentioned Messiaen earlier, Mark Rohan-Hull, and I suppose of all the composers that one might think about, he is the one who most clearly himself kind of saw colour, didn't he, in sound?
Yes, I think you can safely say that he was a synesthete himself.
Just explain what synesthesia is.
I suppose it's a gift that some people, a percentage of the population, have, where one sense triggers another. In some cases, it's quite profound, and one sees a number as a colour.
And in Messiaen's case, I mean, at chords, he actually identified certain chords and notes with a certain colour, didn't he?
Yes, and the transmuting of colours in terms of the notation, in particular with the City Celeste, the foundation stones based on different colours. And
you did some panels, some huge panels in the Festival Hall for a Messiaen.
Yes, that was a great thrill, actually.
And just so that we give the listeners some idea of what your work is like, let's try and describe it. There are great sort of shifting columns of colour, aren't there? I mean, waves of colour.
That's right, yeah. I mean, I spent a lot of time, I had a free run of this wonderful space underneath the Festival Hall, and I listened over and over. The piece was the Mestre Le Pentico by Messiaen, great piece, which is very visual. It's sort of all about the wind of the Holy Spirit and the flames. And I suppose I took that idea, but also listened over and over again and felt the way that the music moved. And
they're quite bold, aren't they? The
yeah, they've got a lot of striking reds and blues, and I used a blue which was lit with complementary colours so that it sort of changed as the music evolved.
Now, tell me, because you've lectured on synesthesia and you've taken part in events to do with it. So do you, when you hear music, when you listen to music, do you hear colours?
Yes, I do. I mean, particularly with discordant clusters of chords, I really see that.
And do you literally, for example, see colours on the palette meshing or actually sort of bouncing off each other almost?
Yes, yeah, particularly complementaries and how things interreact and go from one colour to the other. A bit like if you look intently at a block of red surrounded by grey, the grey will become green. Mm. And I like that sort of power of colour.
That's exactly what a composer can do, isn't it, when he knows how to manage an orchestral palette.
Yes.
He's sort of mixing the sounds in the same way that a painter does. And he knows that if he adds just a little bit of oboe or cor anglais in here,
it'll
just give it that plangency.
Yeah. Very much so, yeah.
The Messiaen we're going to hear, because you've got two pieces of Messiaen, the first piece we're going to hear is what?
The piece that I've chosen is Du Parmi Nous, which I've painted a lot too, and it's actually the first piece that I heard of Messiaen. I was listening to a Radio 3 broadcast of a concert with Gillian Weir, and I heard this, I thought, this is amazing, and I could sense the shapes and the colours in the music. And fortuitously, the next week, Gillian was playing in Oxford, where I live. So I went to see her and took my slides and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then she really understood it and loved it. So it's led to sort of a partnership, really. And we're doing a thing at the Academy of Music shortly. Glorious.
Actually, Gillian Weir, who was playing Dieu parmi nous from La Nativité du Seigneur by Messiaen, said of Messiaen that he was the inimitable painter of sound, I think. But, of course, what we heard there was not just the painting of colours, but in the opening part particularly, that extraordinary phenomenon, birdsong.
Yes.
Very prevalent.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Actually, recently I did an exhibition and I gave a talk with Gillian and Peter Hill, the pianist, did some birdsong pieces to illustrate the effect of colour on Messiaen's music. And there was a moment when he was playing, and it was a beautiful summer's day, and it was in a lovely chapel, Gilbert Scott Chapel in Oxford, and you could hear the birds singing. It was wonderful.
Yeah. He'd have enjoyed that.
Yeah.
Miles Davis next, and I think this is a rather fascinating piece you've chosen, because it was, I think, from a film score, wasn't it, this music?
Yes, it's a lovely story, actually, that I think he was in France and Louis Malle was a great lover of jazz and Miles Davis and got wind of the fact that Miles Davis was in town and got him to do the soundtrack. And I think, personally, I've talked to others about this, that it really affected his playing because they just did it with the film playing, and it sort of made him play in a more abstract and gestural manner.
So, curiously enough, this kind of slight limitation of playing to film ended up being a liberation.
Yeah, I would say so, yeah.
There's something wonderfully sultry, slightly seedy about that. Was it a slightly... What kind of film? Was it a thriller or something?
Yeah, I think it was a detective thriller. I haven't actually seen the film, but the detective thriller type.
And he gets such a marvellous tone, doesn't he?
Oh, wonderful. Well, you just know it's Miles Davis as soon as he puts his mouth to the trumpet. Yeah, wonderful.
Générique from Ascenseur pour l'échafaud, the Louis Malle film, Miles Davis Quintet. Mark Ronhal, we're going to move on to a composer who sometimes gave one a very visual title, like Three Places in New England. But in this question, has given us a more philosophical one, and yet the piece is constructed in quite an art-like way, isn't it?
Yes, I love this composer's music on several counts, but with this particular piece, it reminds me of a big Rothko painting where you have this layer of colour moving backwards and forwards and glimmers of light.
This is the unanswered question by Charles Ives.
Yes.
Which, of course, got a wonderful trumpet solo.
That's right, and that sort of chink of light and sort of questioning.
Yeah, and then he divides the piece into, like Rothko, into very distinct compartments, doesn't he?
That's right, yeah.
Sort of fluttering woodwind and...
Yes, yeah. And just a sort of sublime nature to it. It's almost as it's an endless piece, but so short as well.
It has, I think it does have a kind of haunting quality, this music, as though it is music from another sphere.
Yes, it's almost cosmic, I mean vast.
Thank you. Those quiet string chords are rather like a wash or a curtain of colour, aren't they, in the background,
yeah,
against pale, which everything else is picked out in sort of stark relief.
Yeah, just a terrific sort of feeling of space and light. And I often think of watercolour, the way colours sort of mix and merge and go into one another, and that lovely in-betweenness, I suppose.
The Unanswered Question by Charles Ives. We heard the New York Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Leonard Bernstein. Back to Messiaen, Mark Ronhal, and I guess in a way he is the sort of epicentre of your passion for music and colour, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, no other composer quite sort of touches that.
There's no one quite like him, really, in terms of colour, just because he experienced it so profoundly. This piece that I've chosen was the first piece that I painted to on stage.
Just explain actually, that. In other words, you played the piece and the audience watched you painting as the piece was playing, is that right?
Yes. I mean, when I was sitting the concert at the Festival Hall, when I was looking at the paintings, I was thinking it would be great to actually do it live.
Performance art.
That's right, indeed. And I got the chance to do it at the festival called Music and the Mind Festival, where a pianist called Helen Reed, who's a synesthete herself, played. It worked out wonderfully, actually. And yeah, it's a beautiful piece.
But so fascinating that, again, you've chosen a piece which in one sense is monochrome because it's a solo piano.
Yes, I suppose so.
But as we listen to this, Le Baiser de l'Enfant Jésus from Varaga, and we're going to listen to a performance by Yvan Loriot, as we listen to it, just first tell us what kind of picture you did as the music was going through, so we can imagine in our mind. Just give us one or two clues to what we might see if you were doing it now.
Yes, I'm trying to remember, actually. I mean, it started off very fluid, and then colours came into it, and there were lots of yellows, sparkly colours, intermingled with big shapes, I suppose.
And would you actually attack the canvas rhythmically, if there was a rhythmic thing happening?
In some parts. And it almost becomes like a dance to the piece. Yeah. But I found it was actually quite a moving experience, and I've since worked at the Academy with a violinist called Peter Shepherd, the end of the quartet at the end of time, when there's that lovely sort of bowing sound right at the end, and that it became, I was still painting right at the end, and
right,
it became the the stroke.
Yeah, so your arm
was
moving.
That idea of the painting becoming the music and vice versa.
But there were sparkling moments that we should look out for in this piece.
Absolutely, then. Yes. Yeah. No, plenty of those. And it's very tender. There's lots of texture amongst these big swathes of colour.
And the sound of the cuckoo at the end.
Yes, beautiful, beautiful.
It's very tender, isn't it? The kiss of the infant Jesus, Le baiser de l'enfant Jésus by Messiaen, played by Yvon Loriot.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I recently heard the Messiaen recording of it, and so different, such different playing.
Really? How would you characterise the two?
Messiaen is much faster and more dynamic, yeah, much more dynamic.
And then Yvon Loriot is perhaps more feminine, in a way.
Yes, but he obviously...
More tender.
But yeah.
It doesn't always follow. But. But as we were talking about painting to that, and indeed as you were sort of making movements... It did occur to me that it's a bit like, if you're painting music as you're hearing it, it's a bit like conducting it, isn't it?
Yeah, and I thought this very much. I walked my boys home from school and we got wind that there was a rehearsal of Dido and Aeneas happening at the Holywell Music Room in Oxford. And we popped in and it was an open session at the end of the day. And I was watching John Elliott Gardner conducting. It just suddenly struck me that he was painting. It was the shapes. I could see it all.
Well, it's not the Dido, but it is John Elliott Gardner we're going to hear next. And this is a composer that... well, of course, he is dissonant in some ways, but not in the contemporary way we've been hearing. But he's very important to you, Bach.
Yes, I've always had Bach in the background, I suppose, since I was young. I always find it so powerful, and particularly the passions. They remind me of deep... emotional moments in my life.
And the chorales are so wonderful. We're going to hear the last chorale, but not from the St. Matthew. You've chosen the St. John.
Yes, I love the St. John, actually. It's quite concise, like the Gospel, and it's...
Almost more personal and controlled.
That's right, yes, and particularly this last piece, which is beautiful.
Interesting that he, John Elliott Gardner, keeps that moving quite brisk at the end. I'd be tempted to take it rather slowly at the summation of this wonderful piece.
Yeah, I went to see this exhibition of Poussin paintings at the Royal Academy. It was a while ago. That music really reminds me of that, the poise and the gesture, finely balanced and...
So there was no wearing of the heart on sleeve either there or in the Poussin.
No, that's right. But also the way that, particularly the Eucharist paintings by Poussin, it's all so finely balanced, the colours, and then there's this sort of tiny, beautiful, jewel-like blues. And I find that in Bach's music a lot. I like to paint to Bach, actually.
Ach, Herr, lass dein Lieb Engelein, the last chorale from the St. John Passion by Bach. And we heard the Monteverdi Choir and English Baroque soloists conducted by John Elliott Gardner. I think it's true to say, Mark Rohnhall, that all the music you've chosen is very idiosyncratic. The composers are pretty instantly recognisable, and that's certainly true of the next one.
Yes, Janáček. I heard this quite recently. It's quite an obscure piece, I think. I hadn't come across it before. it's just got this powerful feeling of grief, and
it's very emotionally wrought, his music, isn't it? But I think that these piano pieces, especially From an Overgrown Path, are slightly more elliptical than the operas.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I find they're very pictorial. You can see things happening and coming in and out. And
well, he's called it The Barn Owl Has Yet to Fly Away.
And, of course, there's this quite picturesque sort of feeling of this owl swooping in and out.
I should tell everyone that you've got your wings out at the moment and are in a rather beautiful glide, but nobody can see it.
That's right.
However, we can hear Andras Schiff interpret it for you. It is, as you say, very grief-laden, isn't it?
Yeah, earthy as well, very
earthy. All his music has that quality.
I like that nature.
I think. Yes.
Yeah.
The barn owl has yet to fly away from On an Overgrown Path by Janáček, and we heard András Schiff playing it beautifully there. Mm. We're going to conclude, Mark, with something which is a complete change of mood, but maybe there are some similarities here too for you, I don't know.
Well, I suppose he's idiosyncratic, definitely. Mm. When I was young, I used to listen to this music a lot, and Freddie Mercury, such a flamboyant performer, and very visual, the way he moves and everything. I was amazed when I was young. And
but the music was good too, wasn't it? Because it was interesting. It did things harmonically that you didn't quite expect.
Yeah, great. And I recently saw a programme about the making of an album and how amazingly detailed they were about overlaying voices. And I see sort of painting parallels in that as well.
And this song in particular, what do you like about it?
I just love the joy of it, and there's something about it which is just the perfect pop song in a way. It just makes you feel happy and elated, and yeah, great fun.
Tonight I'm gonna have myself a real good time. I feel alive, and the world.
Don't Stop Me Now, Queen, and of course the incomparable Freddie Mercury. Yeah. Great solo from Brian May as well.
Yeah, I used to love this sort of double act, the way that he sort of graciously flew around in his big dressy things, and Of course, Freddie in his leotard leaping around.
It's very clever, the songs, too. They're very precise, the way they put them.
This is great.
In fact, I should have asked you earlier, really, Mark, do you find, not in terms of something like Queen, but do you find the composer's scores interesting to look at as works of art?
Yes, beautiful, some, yes.
Because the calligraphy can be amazing, can't
That's
it?
That's right, yes.
And for, there was even in the recent Royal Academy exhibition, they had some of Bert Whistle's What He Doodles With. And it's quite fascinating to see how close, you know, calligraphy and art is in that way.
He was interested, actually. I went to see a talk by Harrison Bert Whistle where he was saying that he sort of uses it like collage. And he was talking about the influence of Guston, Philip Guston, on his work.
Well, I've often thought that something I like about using a pencil on paper is that there's a tactile feel to writing music, and you do actually sometimes feel almost as though you're layering on sound like paint.
That's right, and with Messiaen, very much so. I find there's a real link with collage and the way he uses the bird song and the Indian rhythms and the colour.
Well, thank you very much, Mark Rohnhal, for drawing these analogies between music and painting, and it would be very fascinating one day to see you painting live to a piece.
Yeah, well, hopefully you'll see me at some point. But, yeah, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you.